Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a show by, for, and about young people. It airs on the first Sunday of each month from 3 to 4 p.m. and is hosted by young people in Mendocino County. We want to create a place where young people can talk truthfully about important issues in our lives. This led to huge street protests and a revolution that ousted the president. This inspired the wave of insurrections that became known as the Arab Spring. In Egypt, the people occupied Tahrir Square as the whole world watched, with most Western nations cheering the overthrow of President Mubarak. Algeria, Jordan, Yemen, and many other Northern African and Middle Eastern nations quickly joined in with attempts to overthrow their governments. The most widely publicized was the regime change in Libya, which involved massive foreign military intervention. Unlike the earlier uprisings, which were accomplished primarily by citizens, the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi included nearly 10,000 bombing raids by NATO forces and the United States. Protests are continuing in Yemen, Syria, Bahrain, and several other countries. Huge student protests against austerity measures began in London in November of 2010, and in May of this year, nationwide protests took off in Spain. In Wisconsin, demonstrators against government cutbacks began in February this year and continue. On September 17th, the first gathering of Occupy Wall Street was attended by several thousand citizens. 2 weeks later, a declaration of the occupation of New York City was published. It called for a peaceful assembly with three main goals: opposition to system-wide corruption, the end of corporate profit over the interest of the people, and a restoration of a democracy not determined by economic power. Occupy Wall Street is a movement without leaders. It was brought about by the taxpayers' bailout of the banking industry, which had created an economic collapse through corruption and personal greed. Fraudulent banking practices led to massive foreclosures of homes being bought by American citizens, and the loss of jobs and government-funded programs. Other reasons for the movement include the huge cost to receive a college education, corporate outsourcing of labor, and king-size bonuses to corporate executives. In the 7 weeks since Occupy Wall Street began, the grassroots Occupy movement has spread to hundreds of cities in the United States and several thousand cities worldwide. The Occupy Oakland actions have seen huge crowds peacefully demand that the culture move away from allowing banks and corporations to rule the nation. At the same time, there has been a small number of people destroying property and police using violence to stop the protests. When Americans watched this happen in Egypt, they cheered on the protesters. When this occurs in our own country, many people are cynical or outraged that the protesters do not disperse when told to and complain when they are attacked by police. In Mendocino County, demonstrations have been taking place in Ukiah and Fort Bragg, though so far there are no encampments involved. Some groups from here have been attending Bay Area events and taking supplies for demonstrators. Information about the Ukiah group can be found at their website, occupyukiah.org. What we want to do on today's show is to present what we have learned about the Occupy movement, give our perspectives on what is occurring, and then discuss with you why people are demonstrating. Aron and I attended the October 15th rally in San Francisco, and we will describe that for you. A former You Speaks Out host, Jenny Pearson, will give us a call from UC Berkeley and describe the Oakland protests from last Wednesday. Then we will open the phone lines for your insights and questions. We hope that you will want to be a part of this exploration. Aron, let's begin by describing our expectations on the way to San Francisco for the October 15th rally.
Personally, what I wanted to see is experience what was the entire Wall Street movement. We see it in the news, and we started seeing a little bit on television, and I wanted to see what it was like. I mean, you read about it in the papers, and then it's an opportunity to go and actually see what people are doing to express their ideas of how they feel about what's happening in our economy. I was surprised when we saw as many people as we saw, because initially we were looking for the protests and we only found bits of pieces. And
Yeah. It was kind of interesting. I mean, you hear about things in history and you hear about things in the news, but I mean, it really is never clear to you just what these things are until you go there. I mean, we go to history class and such, and you hear about these amazing things and you don't really feel like you can ever be a part of something like this. And that's really what I felt when I was going to this movement, is how could there be several thousand people? How could there be this massive movement, and how could I be a part of it? And that was kind of confirmed when we got there, and quite ironically, could not find the movement. But when we finally found the march, it was just awe-inspiring. It was incredible. There were over 1,000 people there. I mean, it really dawned on me that I can be a part of this. I can be a part of a massive movement. I can be a part of history. And that's really the biggest shock to me from this. Now, we'd also like to move into the history of this movement. It started out pretty small and ragtag, and was really criticized for being disorganized, and it has kind of formed into a bigger thing.
However, these people, they seem to have developed some interests and goals, but they don't really seem to have anything set up so they can maybe elect a presenter, politician towards their cause. The protests in New York and San Francisco seem to have been gaining attention from the media and the like, but they seem to have so many different demands and so many different ideas that it seems quite difficult for them to actually go out and accomplish all of their goals.
We have the list of the Declaration of the Occupation of New York City, and these are more or less a list of their demands, and they are quite numerous. I mean, here's one. They have profited off the torture, confinement, and cruel treatment of countless animals and actively hide these practices. Now, I personally am definitely against animal cruelty, but one thing I think is we should probably focus on the very big things at this time. And I personally think the big things are that the rich pay unfairly low taxes, and that the system is rigged so that the rich can take over the country and really practice terrible acts of fraud on the public.
Well, we've mentioned about how there's no real solid message that the people, for example, a politician who they could vote into office. But I guess the movement is really normal people going out and speaking out their views. So in a sense, this isn't going to be purely political. It's not going to be about whether it's a Democratic Party winning or the Republican Party winning, but simply about the people and the constituents who both these parties represent. It's them speaking up to their politicians, to the media, to everyone else, what they want.
It's a very populist movement, meaning it's coming from the people. It's not truly leaders getting up and designing their own committee to decide what's best for the country. It's the country standing up and telling these committees what they want. And one thing I found really interesting is that here, reading about the New York City Declaration, it says that they have an assembly that requires 90% agreement on something to make a decision. And I'm sorry, that was actually the Occupy Oakland General Assembly that has this. So, I mean, that's pretty incredible. That if you want to call this group unorganized, I mean, they're really more organized than the American government. Because, I mean, since when have we seen a vote in the House of Representatives or in Congress or an election or in anything where we have a 90% agreement? I mean, it's just not practical in our government. Yet these people are accomplishing this and getting things done with 90% agreement. And I think that's pretty incredible.
The one argument to that is obviously that there really aren't that many people. I mean, if you consider the populations of both San Francisco and New York, they're humongous, in the millions, and there's a couple of thousand people here who have, in 90% of them, all agreed to take down the 1%. Now, in my opinion, 90% of a couple thousand isn't really going to get much done.
Well, I think they actually already have gotten things done. Because if you look, Bank of America recently was planning on instating charges, I believe, on debit cards. I think it was $5 a month. And that was canceled, and they put in their official statement that was partly due to protests. Well, I'd say it's, quite ironically, 99% due to protests. I mean, the 99%, as they call themselves, did stand up to this, in my opinion, unfair charge, and they succeeded. And I think the great thing we see now is legislation was passed that lowered the fee these banks could charge on merchants. And that is why they wanted to charge us this $5 a month. So now we've denied their $5 a month charge. Unless they can find some more subtle, sneaky way to take money from us, they will have to give up their absurd and unfair profits.
The banks say it's to compensate for the loss of profits that they'll have, but in truth, they're just trying to make more and more money. I mean, the $5 seems fairly unreasonable, and I guess this is a clear example of how people can protest through, you could say, unconventional demonstrations of how they feel. Throughout the whole movement, these last couple of weeks, people have been withdrawing their accounts from the major banks, Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, etc. And I guess they're really demonstrating that they don't support what these banks are doing. Instead, the people are taking their money and putting it into more local credit unions, and that's strengthening their local economy. And I think that's a clear example of what people can do. I mean, common everyday people that can't go to the city and protest, they can just change the way they move their money and show the companies how they feel about what they're doing.
It seems that they have been capable of getting things out and speaking their opinion to the public. But it tends to show that they don't have a leader. It's just a bunch of people out on the street. Everybody has their own voice. It's great that everyone has their own opinion and they can all speak out, but there doesn't seem to be a strong leader, and that may be a detriment to their cause.
I think it's a call to the leaders who are already instated. It's a call to the Congress members, the Senate members, all of the men who are already enacted in office, and these are their demands. This is what the people want. That's why these men were elected. They were elected to represent their constituents, and that's what the constituents are doing now. They don't need to have new politics. They need the people who are already voted in to say what the people that they represent want.
So we've heard a lot about the history of this movement and kind of what they are. So, and we have gone into why a little, but I'd like to talk a little more about that. If any of you have watched the documentary Inside Job, it is a spectacular movie and I would recommend it. And I'd like to talk about something I learned from that. Now, there's something called the securitization food chain, in which when you take up a loan with a bank, what that lender then does is they take your loan and they sell it as an investment to an investment bank. So it now, instead of paying your lender, you are now paying an investment bank on your mortgage or whatever it is. And what the investment bank does with all these thousands of loans they buy off lenders is they then package them into big packages, I believe are called CDOs, and then they pay ranking agencies and rating agencies to give these packages good ratings, and then they market these packages to investors. So what happens is you are now paying an investor every time you make a mortgage payment. Now, the problem with this is now the lender, why does he care if you pay him back? Why does he care what kind of loan he makes? Because no matter what loan, no matter whether or not you pay him back, he makes money. So what happens is lenders before the 2008 economic collapse would make awful loans to people who they had knew had no chance of paying back the loans. And then they would disguise these loans with investment banks as good investments and sell these to the investors, who then lost all their money when the economy collapsed in 2008. So what happens is lenders make more money by making bad loans. And I feel this is a huge problem. It is something that really needs more attention and focus.
So do you think that that would be done through bank regulations? I mean, if the bank's allowed to make loans to people who cannot do it, shouldn't that be against the code of a bank?
Oh, most definitely. And I mean, one thing is, if you watch the movie Inside Job, you can see hearings with these big bank lenders, and they ask him these questions. They say, is it your duty to protect and inform your customers and clients about the investments they are making? And what one of the big players said was, it is solely our duty to inform our clients on the prices of investments. So basically what he just said there is, it doesn't matter if we steal money from our investors. Our only duty is to give them information on the pricing of investments. So clearly the banks don't think they're accountable for this. The investors don't think they're accountable for this. And I think it's up to the FEC and other government functions to make them accountable.
Well, we're talking about the banking now, and well, how I see it, one of the things that led to the collapse of the housing market was the variable rates and the fixed rates. The variable changed depending on how the economy was doing. So in essence, people would get the variables and they would be able to pay the payment. But then when the variable rate went up, it was completely out of their reach and they were no longer able to pay their mortgage. So how does that relate to how it, in the big idea of things, how did that lead to the collapse of the economy?
Well, I think it really ties into why the Occupy movement exists. It's because the entire setup has been rigged by the wealthy elite to take money from you, to take money from the 99%. And what the Occupy Wall Street movement is us saying this is wrong. We need our money back. We are hardworking people, and that we have been just really robbed. And that's what we're doing. We're telling the government, don't let them rob us. Don't let this happen again. Hold them accountable.
The issue with that, though, is that we live in a capitalistic society, and really, they don't have any regulations on themselves, so we need to put regulations on the government. We can't just stand by and sit down and take it.
I think this really goes into the broader concept of laissez-faire. I personally think laissez-faire is failing. You can't have an entirely free market because the market is under no obligation to protect you. And this securitization chain really tells you this, is that the market can't be free because the market isn't accountable to you, that they can make money no matter what happens to you. And that is why we need our votes to hold the market accountable. And we need our voice to hold them accountable.
You mentioned laissez-faire. You could say that most corporations like the idea of laissez-faire because laissez-faire means that it's free, no restrictions, and that means that they're not restricted in any way, they're not regulated. But it's ironic because once they're in trouble, when they make bad decisions, they don't want the laissez-faire. They want the government to step in and bail them out. For example, the AIG, I mean, clearly that's a clear example of how laissez-faire does not work. They claim that they like it, but then once they're the ones in trouble, they don't want laissez-faire anymore.
What I think they want is, I think they want corporatism. And I feel that many of our Republican politicians support corporatism, and they just hide it under the thin guise of laissez-faire. I mean, I think all the bailouts are an example of that. I think even Obama is guilty of bailouts. And this isn't laissez-faire, this is corporatism. This is the government acting for not the people, but 1% of the people. I mean, they're even calling corporations people. I mean, by their own twisted ideas, they are treating the people. They are serving the people. But, I mean, when you call corporations people, then are you really still serving the people?
So now, if you're calling corporations people, what about average citizens? When they're in debt, does the government bail them out? That's what I'd like to kind of see. If you can bail out a corporation, why can't you bail out the average American people who are real people, not just claiming to be people?
One interesting thing we'd like to kind of segue into is, who do you find at these demonstrations? And for the most part, I think they're young people. Wouldn't you two agree?
Yes. And I also saw people who looked like they were in their 60s. Late 50s, and I guess that could kind of translate into people who were around in the 70s when there was a lot of revolution going on and people were speaking out their minds towards the government.
Not only people in the older ages groups and the younger age groups are attending these things, though. Many military veterans and military advocates have been attending the Occupy Wall Street events because they feel that they have not been fairly compensated for their service to the United States of America. They feel that they have not gotten what they deserved for their services, and they, specifically Scott Oslin, have been hurt by police in their attempts to protest.
Tell us a little bit about Scott Oslin. Who is he? And
Scott Oslin was an Iraq war veteran. He's 24 years old, and he is currently in the hospital with a head wound that he sustained during protests with the Oakland police. He was supporting the 99%, and the police felt that he was being too aggressive, I suppose.
And one thing I think was pretty interesting and incredibly ironic is, if I understand things right, and you guys can confirm this, is during his tour of duty, he was not injured. He was never injured in Iraq. And then he comes home to the place we consider safe, the place we call the American dream, and then he gets hurt. I mean, is America less safe than Iraq? I mean, that just sounds scary. I don't think this is right.
Especially when he's exercising his First Amendment right to assemble, he's simply expressing his opinions. And another thing we're mentioning veterans is they go to war and they're away from the United States. But then when they come back, there's no jobs for them. So right away, they have bills to pay, and the government isn't really doing much for these veterans. I mean, this is how we pay back people who are meant to defend the country of the free and the brave. That's how we repay the brave. It just seems ironic that that's what these veterans come back to, just bills and no jobs. So I guess that's one thing to show why some veterans and ex-Marines are returning and going to these protests. The economy's in turmoil, and they don't have a job to go to. They have nothing.
And I believe that our American peace that we want, the goal we would seek, is not a place where everyone agrees, where everyone is on the same page, but somewhere where everyone feels free to speak their mind, where no one will get hit in the head with tear gas for speaking their mind. And one thing to talk about is, for the vast majority of people in these protests, and for the majority of protests, they are peaceful. My parents went with me to the Occupy Wall Street protest in San Francisco on the 15th, and what they told me is they were stunned at how peaceful the crowd was. They were around during the 70s, and my dad was in Berkeley protests, and what they found was this was so much more peaceful. And I think it's just awful that there's, say, maybe 3, 4, 5 people in a crowd of hundreds of people who decide to throw bricks, who decide to throw rocks, and as a result, the entire crowd gets tear gassed, and the media jumps on this as just some mob, when it's just 3 or 4 people. And another thing to mention is, and I personally can't confirm this at all, but I know in the past, in the 70s and 60s and so on, there were people who were hired to turn peaceful protests into mobs and riots through violence. I mean, there definitely isn't any evidence for this, but I would really like to be curious, could that be happening now? Could there be, say, a Tea Party member who decides that they don't like this movement, who decides that they will go into a crowd of hundreds of people and throw the first brick, to throw the first rock, and egg the police on, just to make the entire Occupy movement look bad?
You mentioned how the media perceives a couple actions of violence as a mob, so I guess you could kind of bring into action how the media affects the public views of what's happening around the world. We've mentioned how the Libya, Yemen, and all these things have been a bit more violent than here. Here is a simple union. People gather around a certain area where they know they will be heard, and they're expressing their opinions.
And I'd like to say that it seems that the more violent protests over in the Middle East seem to be getting more things done. We're all just here sitting around and sitting in circles and chanting kumbaya and saying we don't like this, whereas over in the Middle East they're shooting guns and taking down leaders. And I think, not to say that we should shoot anyone, but we might want to be a little bit more aggressive with this. You can't just go in half-assed and not expect anything to happen. I mean, not to expect anything to happen.
Well, one thing I'd like to point out is, and this is something that I heard from my dad, is he said that during the Nixon administration, whenever he increased bombings, people would go out in the streets and they would smash storefronts. And what happened was the merchants went and complained to Nixon. So every time Nixon considered increasing bombings, he had to also consider about the reaction from merchants, about the reaction from people. But another thing I would like to say as a disclaimer to all this is I don't feel that the times are quite as extreme here as they were then and as they were in the Middle East. So I do not feel that this very, very radical measure is necessary here. And I feel we are accomplishing good, as I said, with the cancellation of the $5 fees that Bank of America wished to charge.
Again, by exercising violence, you're giving away the First Amendment right, because the First Amendment right is to peaceably assemble. Once that becomes violence, the police can put it down. And another thing to see is during the Civil Rights Movement, they wanted to perceive the movement as peaceful. You'd have Martin Luther King and Malcolm X on different sides. Malcolm X would be the more violent, who called people to arms, and Martin Luther King was the more peaceful. So now, the more recognized movement is Martin Luther King's, because his was of peace. His marches did not involve violence, which is why they seemed to work. So instead of being remembered for being violent, he was remembered for being peaceful and getting things done in a way that hadn't been done before.
Well, it seems that that is, of course, obviously true. But also, Malcolm X was seen as a visionary, and he had his own plan, and his plan did actually have some moderate success. What I'm saying is not that we should not have peaceful demonstrations. We should most definitely have peaceful demonstrations. But maybe if there was, say, a Malcolm X to the general populace, well, there's no really leaders in this, but if there was a more violent form, it might receive even more attention from the media and even more attention from the people, and more people would get involved, because violence is not necessarily the answer, but it feels like maybe it'd be getting more done.
So you think that the violence would attract more attention, and I guess I understand where you're coming from, because if there's violence and they're calling for something to be done, the people who are the congressmen and legislators are going to do something to stop this violence from continuing on. So in essence, violence does get things done, but it does it in a different way, in which this movement does not want to appear violent.
Okay, so we have Jenny Pearson on the line, who attended an Oakland protest for Occupy Wall Street, and we would like to hear from her. I'm sorry, we're having some technical difficulties here. So, in the meantime, let us talk about the goals of Occupy Wall Street. What might we be able to accomplish with this movement?
I think that it's the equalization of people who are the common people, the 99%, and they want to be able to live more comfortably. I guess they want the American dream back. I guess the American dream is to be able to have your house, your car, nice and happy, and it seems that it's disappearing because of so much debt that's in the world, and I think that's what they really want back. They want to be able to dream of something and be able to reach it, and not just have the illusion of dreaming, but actually have the possibilities of achieving their dream.
It seems that one of the main goals of the Occupy is to make sure the Fifth Amendment is not abused. Property has been seized in the past, and that's just not okay with the American people.
I'm sorry, we lost Jenny. I think we have her on here again. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
So are you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
All right, so what was Oakland like for you? What did you experience there?
Well, so first of all, I just want to say really good job. I feel like this is a really important topic, and I feel like you guys are doing a really, really good job, so thank you so much. So, yeah, I went to the Occupy Oakland protest last Wednesday, and I know you guys mentioned this. It was really amazing. the environment during the day was peaceful. There were speakers. It was really motivating and inspiring. There were grandmothers, school teachers, college students, toddlers, all participating. And the sense of camaraderie was just, it made it feel like we could really make a difference. And, you know, the fact that there are Occupy movements globally really added to this, like Tahrir Square, Egyptians holding signs. I don't know if you guys saw this, but Egyptians were holding signs supporting the U.S. Occupy movement. And it just really showed how connected the world is. I'm a Middle Eastern studies major, and so I just have to look at the connection between what's happening here and the link with Egypt. A director of this documentary I saw called Egypt and the Revolution, the director, Khaled Syed, said that he believed that the revolution in Egypt played a direct role in influencing the Wall Street protests, which I think is really incredible that a society ruled by such an autocratic government could inspire a democratic society like the U.S. And I know that you guys talked about this too, the linkage. So anyways, just bringing it back to Oakland, as far as the UC Berkeley campus was concerned, the students and the faculty were really supportive of the Occupy movement. A few of my classes were canceled on Wednesday. And even though I got to the protest at 9 in the morning, UC Berkeley was planning on walking to Oscar Grant Square in Oakland at 12, which is a good hour and a half away from campus, and it was amazing. Around 300 people walked that whole way, and it was just really incredible what the UC Berkeley students and faculty did, and there's so many people. Another thing that I think is really important, in my opinion, and I know, I think, Casey, you talked about this before, was the way the media portrays the protests and the way the world sees these protests through the lens of the media. I'm sure you all heard about the violence that happened that night, and also during the other protests, the vandalism and broken windows and spray-painted walls. And it's just really interesting to see that the media focuses on the few people who do these negative things and forget that the majority are only exercising their right to free speech in a very peaceful way. And I truly don't believe that the vandalism that happened was caused by the same protesters that were there in the morning, but by a very small group later that night, which is really unfortunate because it puts the efforts of the protesters in really bad light and makes the government undermine the Occupy movement, which is sad, but it's also very true. Also, I was hoping you guys could talk about this a bit more, the difference between rioters and protesters, and the diction in the media that chooses to use the word rioters instead of protesters. And I thought that was interesting. Maybe if you guys could talk about that a little bit, I'm interested in what you guys, what your opinions are on that. Also, what I learned from all this is that while we're standing together as the 99%, we still have a lot of work to do. But it makes a big difference that that it's not just Occupy Oakland and it's not just Occupy Ukiah or Occupy Denmark, but it's a global Occupy movement and that the whole world is standing together in this. And it's also extraordinary to see the extent to which people will go, even putting themselves in danger, like Saul Olson and others, to accomplish what they really believe in. And just going back to Egypt, a quote in Khaled's documentary was, quote, her children died so our nation can live. See, our nation can live. And they disappeared for their people to stay. And I'm sure it lost something in the translation from Arabic to English. But I feel like it's really powerful. And I just want to hear your thoughts on this quote in relation to the Occupy movement and your thoughts on how this is a global movement, and if you agree with the director Khaled that these protests are just snowballing and one is inspiring the other and that other one is inspiring the other and it's just taking on this global power. So thank you so much. You guys are doing a really good job, and I'll listen to your thoughts off air. Thank you.
Okay. You mentioned wanting to know our thoughts on the effects of whether it was snowballing or not, and we definitely think that it's snowballing. During the Egypt protests, we saw the use of technology. It was Google and Facebook. So I guess you could kind of take that into mind, how the widespread of information is very fast compared to before. This popped into my mind, and I thought I'd mention it. During the American Revolution, that also inspired revolutions in France and other places. So I guess when you see one revolution or one protest kind of go successfully, it gives the people hope that perhaps they can have the same things, that their cries can also be heard and that they have a voice, which is what is happening right now. You saw Yemen try to liberate itself, and Libya has just been liberated. So I guess that's really bringing out an example of a successful revolution, and it's definitely inspiring people far and wide, and I think that it definitely is snowballing.
Casey? Well, what I think is that it's hope. I think when you see somebody rise up and you see success stories all over the world, it gives people hope. And as you said, with all this technology we have, we can spread the hope that the Middle East has given us hope. And this most definitely is a worldwide problem. Like in the economic crisis of 2008, the first ones to fall were Greenland. It's not just us. Everybody is falling.
And with that economic downfall, we obviously haven't gotten out of that, so it's still a very...
I'm sorry, that was Iceland. I said Greenland. My apologies.
Yeah, Iceland did take a humongous dip.
So, back to your question about rioters versus protesters. One interesting thing is a protest can turn into a riot not because of the mentality of the people, but because of police action. Like in the 60s and 70s, maybe one person, maybe two people would act out, and the police would jump on this as an excuse to move in. And when you throw tear gas into any organization, no matter how peaceful, chaos will erupt and it will become a riot.
You mentioned the diction of the two words. Riot is typically perceived as negative, whereas protesters is a bit more neutral. So clearly, the manipulation of the media has a huge repercussions throughout how the United States and the world in general perceives this movement. If the media wants to perceive it as bad, they just simply switch the words around, the difference between protest and riot. That little bit is the way that the world perceives it, and that in itself influences how people feel about the movement. So, and we also mentioned how the movement wanted to be seen as neutral and peaceful, and how manipulation of the media is a thing that can definitely change the game.
All right, thank you, Jenny, for reintroducing these topics. And now we're ready for the call-in part of the show. We're going to open the phone lines now, and the phone number is 456-9991. Everyone is welcome to call, and we'd especially like to encourage the youth in the listening audience. Please call in if you have questions or insights about the Occupy movement. Also, we have mostly expressed support of this movement. However, we'd love to hear from the other side. If you have differing opinions than ours, we encourage you to call in and share your voice with us. Have you been involved in any actions, protests, or support for what is currently being called the 99% movement? If you intended any events, do you think that the media described it honestly? Do you agree that this is the time for citizens to demonstrate about corporate control and the power of banks? What do you think about students incurring significant debts to attend college? Have you or any friends lost a home to foreclosure? Do you know anyone who has lost a job or taken a wage cut because of the economic recession? Can demonstrations change the direction of the country? Is violent repression an inevitable reaction to a civilian uprising? Do these demonstrations make you optimistic or fearful? Do you think that young people will take the lead in reconstructing our democracy? The phone number is 456-9991. When you call, please be ready to turn down your radio or we'll get a very confusing echo. The number is, once again, 456-9991. Please call and be a part of this discussion on Occupy. We'd really like to hear from you.
Caller, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Hello. I'm not in my youth. I'm over 60, so I'll be short. I want to address your comments on violence being more effective way of getting things done. Mm-hmm. And what I want to say is I've been at both the Occupy Oakland and Occupy Mendo demonstrations, and what I see there is mothers with their babies and little old ladies with gray hair. And this movement is being billed as the 99%. Well, once you turn to violence, you're going to cut out 95% of the people, because the people want peace. And peace involves joy, whereas violence involves fear. And that's exactly taking up the tactics of the oppressor. And that's why the movement has to be peaceful, even if it's slower. That's my comment.
I completely agree with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
I agree with the caller as well. However, I have to point out that my support of violence was merely to suggest that the media would become more involved and people would actually pay more attention to it. Like the movements in Libya, violence was involved, and immediately NATO was involved. Everything just went directly to there, and billions of dollars were spent to assist Libya in their freeing from Muammar Gaddafi.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Good observation from someone so young. I'm almost 60 and protested Vietnam and actually lived during a time when people were racist. So these protests are not uncommon in my world, but I'm so pleased to see it happen. The protest isn't enough. We do have to cauterize the movement around some very significant issues, namely speaking for Mother Earth, huge issue that everybody can get on board with, like Earth should be a personhood over a corporation. Come on, you know.
So you'd really like to see a lot of more environmentalism from the movement, is what you're saying?
It's a necessity, because we have a planet that is dying, and we have to really start paying attention to the reasons why, which is gross neglect and rape. It's very simple, rape. For profit, not for the people of the planet, but for profit.
In essence, you are correct. However, I have to say, from the environmental side, in my personal opinion and in the opinion of the people who have taught me my own opinions, being my parents, the human race cannot destroy the planet. We can mess it up pretty badly for ourselves.
We messed it up, though. Yeah, we can't destroy it, but, you know,
we can destroy ourselves.
Kind of where it's at, don't you think?
Well, one thing I would like to say is I really like your idea, where you're coming from here, and something I'd like to draw a connection to is it's much like the environment is the same as us. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, the banks aren't accountable to the people, just as the banks aren't accountable to the environment.
They're the aliens, truly. We are a compassionate, good race of beings, and we've lost our way. You know, in the 60s, there was a glimmer of hope, but the corporation snuffed us out, and we became complacent, and I apologize, because it's under my watch that this has happened. I feel so proud to be able to stand up now with all of you. But really, we have to cauterize this movement into some very simple demands and changes that can occur. Economic restructuring, and also speaking for the planet. And I'll let you guys take someone else.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for your insight there. We're ready for our next caller.
Caller, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. What I want to say is that we have to be reminded of the people that are behind the curtain that are causing this. And those people are the Republicans. They have always stood for money and corporate profit. And they have always, at this point in time, they're blocking everything Obama can do to pass jobs bills. They're not willing to budge. And so that's my belief. They are, the people behind the curtain are the Republicans, and they're the ones that are pulling the strings.
Well, something I would like to say is I definitely agree with you that Republicans are causing a lot of problem, but to use your analogy, I believe that Republicans are the curtain. I don't believe that the people behind the curtain, I believe they are the curtain, and the people behind it are, simply put, the banks. And I also see some fault in the Democrats in that I feel Obama has been far, far too compromising with the Republicans in office. Like, the Bush tax cuts, I feel, were just terrible for the American public.
Completely. And they should all be repealed. And, yeah, Obama, I'm a little bit disappointed in him. I want to vote for him next time because he's the only Democratic, you know, candidate.
Well, there is Randall Terry, but I'm not sure we want him.
I don't want to have another third party dispute either, you know. That always messes things up. Yeah, you're right. The curtain is the Republicans. They're the people who are trying to stop us from the rest of us from making money. I've been on unemployment for a year and a half, and I've seen my wages in the last 10 years go down almost by 50%. I'm a carpenter, and there's just no work. People can't afford to pay the insurance to hire me because, number one, the insurance is too high. So if we could get the jobs bills passed where, you know, people are granted tax exempt, you know, for new employees, people that have been on unemployment, that would pay for the insurance to hire me.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned how you've been on unemployment for a year. Some people say that the unemployed are simply lazy and sitting on their butts, but I think that the amount of jobs available is much less than the people who are looking for jobs. You could say that there's 30,000 jobs, but there's 50,000 applicants. That means there's 20,000 people who aren't going to have jobs.
Absolutely.
So it's unreasonable to say that people who are unemployment are lazy.
An article on Yahoo today that was that was very interesting about that. And then I read the comments about it, and I was actually really astounded that most of the people thought that we were lazy and sitting on our asses. There just isn't – well, like I said, also, you know, I'm a carpenter, and a contractor cannot hire me because it's too expensive for them to pay the insurance rates that it costs to hire me for even a short time. So the job costs go up, you know, 50, 100%. Just because of insurance rates.
There's definitely been a lot of economic decline in this area. People don't need things built so much anymore, and I would like to say, as a young person, it's really difficult to get a job. I've applied to nearly every place in town, and not one of them called me back for an interview, even after I went through the steps in which my school and my parents and everyone told me I should, and go and call them and do this and that and, like, write letters and resumes and all of this. Mm-hmm. And the young people coming into the jobs market are almost entirely ignored. There's no way for us to get a job, even to start with.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is worse for younger people that don't have experience like I do. So it's no better for young people. I'm 50 years old, so it's no better for you. Younger people than it is for the older people.
Well, something I would like to say is you're a carpenter, so you must be pretty skilled in what you do. And, I mean, it seems like nobody even wants skill anymore. I'll be going to college, and it's going to cost me and my parents a fortune. And I will be going into debt. I will have student loans, and I'm really worried, and I hear this from a lot of college grads, is that you learn the skills. You do everything you're supposed to, and then nobody wants you. No matter how much work you do, no matter how hard you try, how much you learn, nobody needs you.
Well, there's a lot of under the table work up here, I guess, and people that have a job, you know, they do the work under the table, and, you know, also there are contractors that just can't afford, like I said, to hire another person because insurance rates for just 1 year is going to be like $5,000. So, you know, they have to make that money back, you know.
Thank you very much, caller. We really like that you brought up unemployment, and thank you for that. And we're ready for our next
caller. You're on the air.
Well, hello, and what a great program! I just am as happy as can be to hear that you're out there doing the work. Several points. A lot of people think about the vote. I'm sorry, but if we keep doing the same thing we've been doing, we have the same result. We're dancing to what's called the golden rule. Them that got the gold is calling the tune.
Mm-hmm.
It's time that we have a constitutional Congress, we now get together and reformulate how elections, how the money goes, and from there we can start to tackle the myriad of problems with solutions that need to be covered. No longer playing in their ballpark. We got to create the next ballpark of the future that deals with human rights and economics and the environment. And so let's get a constitutional Congress going.
Well, one issue I see is how difficult it is to pass an amendment. I mean, I love the Constitution. I think it's a wonderful document, and I think we're really forgetting one of the greatest things about it, is that it was designed to be a living, breathing document. These Tea Partiers like Michelle Bachmann, who claim they will follow the Constitution to the word, I think they're missing the very idea and concept of the Constitution, that this is a document designed to be revised and designed to work with the times, and I think that's something we really need to do.
And rather than giving energy to any of this drama that is like, oh, look over here and get involved in who's the Republican Party, what's the Democrats are doing, it's not working. It's time to put your energy into what you want to see work. And even if we just start with Mendo County and start to create a constitutional Congress with how the votes, how much money each person will get, and we start it by the counties, and we start it by the states. And that's the way I see change occurring.
Thank you very much, caller. And once again, I'd like to encourage anybody who feels they are on the other side of the fence on this issue to come and talk to us. Tell us what you think.
Caller, you're on the air.
Okay. Just got my radio off. Yes, I also thank you for the show. And I had several points, and I'll try and keep them brief. You brought up the use of technology here and the question of whether this was snowballing. I think that this was anticipated in science fiction, actually, and it's now come to pass. The Arab Spring has been enabled by technology, and Occupy is enabled by technology, and it will continue to the technology will continue to enable what's called instantiation of crowds, and if they're mobs, they're mobs, but perhaps they're civilized. The General Assembly is a fantastic thing. I mean, it's on a scale of that we saw in Earth First in the anti-nuclear movement. Much greater scale, and the donations come in, and the organizational challenge that's there that's being met is really, to me, phenomenal. It's terrific.
Thank you for that point on technology. There's something I'd like to say is I think we've seen this throughout history, is with every single technological advance, we see something new in the world. Like with the advancement of radio, we experienced an entirely new culture, a national culture. It really brought people together.
Yes, it gives people choice where there was no choice before. Uh-huh. And that's a terrific enabling thing.
And so another thing,
I'm very encouraged by that. And I would also point to one other thing, is that all of these people are now learning skills. They're learning organizational skills and cooperation skills, consensus skills that they will carry with them. And into the next thing that people will get together on, for good or evil. So there's the question is, how do you deal with the element of anarchy? And how do you stand in relation to it? And can you police yourselves? Can you peacekeep yourselves? So these are open questions, and everybody's giving it their best shot. And I think it's very it's very stimulating.
Thank you, caller. We're ready for our next person.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Wow, what a great discussion. Okay, so I'm thinking about Occupy. Mm-hmm. I'm another mid-50s auntie, sister, mama. And I'm really glad to hear some brother mama's calling up too. Okay, so I feel like there's so much that needs to be occupied. The solution is like one. It's all of a piece. Mm-hmm. And we take apart the things of the world so that we can deal with them and do this and that. But the solution has to be all of a piece. And there's plenty of work to be done. Okay, the corporations have been doing job creation for decades now. There's so much work to be done. A lot of it is cleanup. And it, just like in the government and in politics, there's cleanup to be done there. But there's mm-hmm. something for everybody to do. I would like to see the elders or even the, you know, aunts and uncles sharing their skills with the younger people who, you know, who aren't limited to the political and the technological. And I'm not dissing that in any way. I'm just saying all of it needs to happen. And everything we know and we need is already here. And what can the government do? This to me is the biggest thing with the government. What is its job? You know, well, and if everything has to be about money or law, we can't do it. It can't get done. You know, the stuff that isn't about money and law needs to be met in that way. You know, just with presence. And who can we cooperate with? And how can we share our skills? For jobs, instead of talking about jobs, let's think about the work that already needs to be done. You know, any of us could make a list in our neighborhood, in our community, at any level.
Well, thank you very much, but I'm sorry, we need to wrap up the show here, so thank you.
Okay, I hope.
Okay, so that's all for this month's edition of You Speaks Out. Your hosts today have been me, Casey,
Aron,
and Elwin.
Thanks to our callers. One of the purposes of this show is to involve the community in dialogue, so your call-ins are important to us. We're happy to have been able to broadcast from the Willits studio. You Speaks Out is produced in cooperation with the Safe Schools Healthy Students Bronco Project, building resiliency opportunities for the North County. For more information about the Bronco program, please call Pat Sanborn at 459-5314 or email at psanborn@mcoe.us. You Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490, or through the website www.youthspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project, get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of the show, and listen to many hours of previous programs in streaming audio. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KZYX. They are the views of those who express them. Our next show will be on the first Sunday of December, the 4th, at 3 p.m. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in December.